Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by William Lawrence, visiting professor at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University, and former U.S. State Department Senior Advisor for Global Engagement. He'll speak on the topic Silence, Survival, and Stolen Springs, the Middle East and North Africa. This program was sponsored by the Hannah and Natan Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at UNO and presented in memory of UNO professor and former director of the Schwab Center, Moshe Gershovich, who passed away 1 year ago this week on February 8, 2017. It was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, November 15, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Curtis Hutt, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
I'm going to read something because I couldn't possibly remember all of the things that Bill Lawrence has done in the past. And I'm sure this is only a short list. I find the title is amazing, right? I mean, currently visiting professor at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University in D.C. That's quite a nice gig, right? He was former State Department Senior Advisor for Global Engagement, the International Crisis Group North Africa Director, and just to add, Dr. Gershovich Moshe was an expert on North Africa, right? And I believe that's the connection for the friendship. He's also Control Risks Associate Director for Middle East and North Africa. It's always difficult to see people that had common friends. Moshe introduced me to Bill back at the beginning of the Arab Spring, when Moshe and a number of us were kind of grasping around, looking here, there, trying to get a read on what was going on. And to be able to bring someone like Bill here to help us to understand those dynamics, it was amazing back then. I'm really certain it's going to be amazing today because the world is no less interesting today. Bill, thanks for coming out here and giving us your time. We're really looking forward to this.
Good morning. I'd like to thank Patrick McNamara for organizing my second visit to University of Nebraska, and it's a great pleasure to be back in this wonderful facility. I'd like to thank Curtis for the warm and generous introduction, and I'd like to thank Nate Schwab for his generous contributions to support this program. This speech in memory of Moshe Gershovich is more of a personal reflection, and Moshe inspires every word in this speech. Moshe Gershovich was a mensch, what the Egyptians call a ragel geda, an entirely dependable person of the highest moral character. The Yiddish word mensch comes from the German word mensch, meaning human being, but the Yiddish word means a person of integrity and honor. The opposite of mensch is unmensch, meaning an utterly unlikable or unfriendly person. I'd call Moshe an ubermensch, but Friedrich Nietzsche beat me to it with his philosophizing of the idea of the superman, the overman, the superhuman. But in an article in the Jewish press, Dr. Joan Latchow, in memory of Moshe, lovingly recalled, years ago a colleague asked me, what is the definition of a mensch? I rifled through my mental dictionary and responded, someone who is responsible, kind-hearted, and compassionate. But those traits, laudable as they are, didn't have the tam, the spirit, the feel embodied in the Yiddish word. I finally gave up and named a person we both knew. Instantly, my colleague understood. Moshe Gershovich was a quintessential mensch. Just 8 months and a week ago, Moshe left us, leaving a big hole in many of our lives, to be filled nonetheless with incredible memories, memories that motivate us to do well by others, to do the right thing in our human interactions and in our scholarship. In the fall of 1995, Moshe contacted me. He was applying for a research grant, and he was asking for my feedback on the application. It was an amazing application, and I happily gave him my feedback. And then I decided, boy, I'd really like this fellowship as well. So I called up Moshe, and I said, Moshe, I'm going to apply for the same grant. But if I get it, and you don't, I think there were three of them being offered, I'll take you on a trip to Morocco with part of the money and get your research started. Well, that's exactly what happened. With Moshe's help, I got the grant, and he didn't. And I took him to Morocco for a couple-week trip where I introduced him to all the Moroccan veterans I knew and to Moroccan culture, and this began a long, many-year love affair, I think, that Moshe had with Morocco. He wrote about this trip in a blog entry. He wrote, late in the afternoon, I was about to conclude a long road trip that I had started earlier that morning in Casablanca. With me driving the car we had rented was my friend Bill. It was the mandatory fasting of the holy month from daybreak to dusk. Out of respect and consideration, I too abstained from eating or drinking that day. Now as we were approaching the small town just off the main internal road connecting the imperial capitals of Fez and Marrakesh through the Middle Atlas, we were thoroughly hungry and thirsty. The observance of Ramadan in Morocco is virtually universal, save for the occasional group of ill-informed tourists. It's impossible to see anyone eating or drinking in public. Restaurants and cafes close down during the month, while nighttime features a happy gathering of people outdoors. During the day, streets are far less crowded than usual, as most Moroccans spend their time indoors. By contrast, an hour later, at the breaking of the fast, the streets are deserted and silent. It was this silence that welcomed us as we entered Al Qasiba and made our way to the home of I.O., and he gave the initials, an old friend of Bill and our host for the night. Entering the modest dwelling, I came face to face for the first time with the simply irresistible warmth and hospitality of the Middle Atlas Imaziren, independent men, a.k.a. Berbers. No matter how poor they may be and how meager their material assets, they would never hesitate to share them and offer their guests the most lavish fare they can afford. Moshe goes on to describe the breaking of the fast, the array of appetizers and hard-boiled eggs with cumin, bowls of Moroccan hadida soup, and breaking the fast with the date and ending with a glass of tea. Anyway, he concluded his blog entry, in the years since, I have had many opportunities to visit Moroccan homes and share meals with their members. I have experienced fine cuisine and feasts that took place in breathtaking places, like surroundings that appear to be taken straight out of the pages of Arabian Nights. And still in my mind, I will always remember most fondly that modest breaking of the fast in a small town among complete strangers who would soon become friends. Moshe didn't stop there. I'd been confused during my years in Peace Corps in this town. I kept meeting all these veterans who nobody liked. And yet I didn't, and I've worked on film and research, but I never really kind of knew how to work them into my research and production. Well, Moshe figured it out. And he got to know all the veterans in that town and throughout the Middle Atlas Mountains and exhibited a level of empathy for them I have never seen from anyone in those towns, from anyone, any of the scholars in the Middle Atlas, from any of the Moroccan scholars who work on Moroccan historical subjects. Moshe's work on these subaltern Moroccans who had fallen through the sociological and analytical cracks was profound, relentless, and transformational. In a passage from one of his I think this was in the Journal of North African Studies, he wrote, the overwhelming majority of veterans live in deplorable conditions. Aged, sick, frail, they pass the remaining years of their lives in poverty and purposelessness, desperately reliant upon the assistance of their offspring to survive. The medals and other citations they earned as tokens of their heroism and loyalty, while carefully guarded and proudly displayed in front of the foreign visitor, can hardly make up for the insultingly meager pensions and disability payments that the veterans receive from France. It is hardly surprising, therefore, that the single common opinion on which virtually all veterans seem to agree is that France has mistreated them and ought to compensate them better for the sacrifices they made on its behalf. These Moroccans fought the toughest battles of World War II, tougher than D-Day, like the Battle of Monte Cassino. One account of it said that after Anzio, the Germans occupied defensive positions known as the Winter Line, consisting of bunkers, barbed wire, minefields, and ditches. The four successive Allied assaults on these positions became known as the Battle of Monte Cassino. The fight resembled a World War I battle, with artillery bombardments preceding bloody infantry assaults on fixed positions. Success was bought at the cost of more than 50,000 casualties on the Moroccan, on the Allied side. Today, the battle is mainly remembered for the destruction of the Abbey of Monte Cassino, which was sheltering civilians, by more than 100 B-17 flying fortresses when the Allies mistakenly believed the Abbey to be a German artillery observation position. I remember that there were no mentions of the Moroccans in most of the historical accounts. And I remember on my first trip to Pearl Harbor, having worked with Moshe, I looked at there was a map of the world and where all the veterans in World War II came from. And there was France with a certain number and nothing for North Africa. And I was aware that there had been thousands and thousands of Moroccans, Algerians, Tunisians that had fought on the Allied side. But they were, even though Morocco was a protectorate, they were considered French soldiers, right, in the historiographical accounts. Now, Moshe went on in another one of his articles, he wrote about this recognition over time. He said, in the summer of 2004, five Moroccan veterans were chosen as members of the French delegation visiting Italy for the commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the conclusion of the Battle of Monte Cassino to the south of Rome. While meant to pay tribute to the bravery of those veterans and their compatriots, the event carried a certain ironic undertone, given the aforementioned ill repute of Moroccan combatants as rapists, plunderers, and murderers among the rural population of that meeting. You may remember there was an Italian film, a very famous film made about the sort of Moroccan rape of the countryside, which was mostly not true, but to this day it's very much in the Italian imagination and memory of World War II. One may assume, of course, that the veterans chosen for the task had been carefully vetted by the French-run Service des Anciens Combattants in Casablanca, to exclude anyone suspected of such wrongdoing. Throughout that decade, Moroccan veterans of the Second World War, by then in their 80s or older, continued to be subject to discriminatory policy that essentially robbed them of their pensions and benefits from the French army. In 1961, on the eve of France's withdrawal from Algeria, the French legislature passed a law that froze the level of payment to all North African veterans at the current rate. That legislation remained unchanged by successive and different French administrations condemning those aging, forgotten heroes of another era to lives of misery and want. And partially through Moshe's efforts, and I can talk about that more in the Q&A if you want, but only in 2002 did the French legislature begin to move towards rectifying this injustice and improving the benefits awarded to North African veterans. This slow-moving process accelerated in 2006 following the dramatic public reception of the premiere of Bouchardib's film Indigène, led by then-President Jacques Chirac's public discourse about injustice suffered by the veterans finally led to swift correction of the law and restoration of their rights, including some back pay. Unfortunately for most of the Moroccan veterans, the charge had come too late to matter much as they had passed away in the meantime. Moroccan historian Driss Maghraoui, writing of Moshe's work, said, the participation of many thousands of troops recruited in France's overseas colonies, including many Moroccan infantrymen known as goumiers, had been overlooked by historians and left out of the accounts of significant battles of the Second World War. Yet Moroccan soldiers took part in some of the fiercest combat in the Mediterranean region, in Tunisia, in Sicily, in Corsica, in the liberation of Marseille, and went on to liberate Paris and provided manpower for the invasion of Germany at great cost. Tracing the trajectory of the Goumier units in the latter years of the war, this essay recovers many of the details of their suppressed history, situating the memory of their exploits along with the recollection of some of their less heroic deeds, along with new frameworks of interpretation informed by the idea of empire, historiography of race, and narratives of colonial exploitation. American historian Tom DeGeorge wrote, Moshe Gershovich's scholarship focuses on how military service changed Moroccan veterans' world outlook following the Second World War. In his impressive work with interviewing Moroccan veterans, Gershovich peels away their subaltern silence to reveal alternating feelings of pride, neglect, and despair, which motivate survival strategies in post-colonial Morocco. One of Moshe's many brilliant insights was how colonialism and imperialism depended on collaboration. And imperialism becomes impossible to sustain when the collaboration ends. No one else had this insight. Through most of his research, he discovered that in 1956, a fascinating part of the French decision to leave Morocco and leave it to its independence was the lack of support of rural Moroccan veterans of World War II in the continuing French colonial project. That, without that military support, the French would no longer be able to hold the rural areas, making their protectorate, putting their protectorate at risk. Moshe would shine spotlights and not glorify his subject, as we often find in this type of study, but he would expose all sides, as mentioned in some of the quotations above, all sides of complex problems in a passionately dispassionate fashion, engendering respect for the disrespected and empathy for the forgotten, but in a way that problematized what they'd done, including the complex discussion of what Moroccan veterans had done in Italy. In one interesting quote in one of his books, one of the veterans said, "Everyone considered those who worked with the French treasonous. Even my wife did." And yet, Moshe validated what they'd done through his work and restarted, in many senses, a conversation among Moroccans about how they were treated those veterans of the war. Now, for all of his time spent traipsing around the Middle Atlas Mountains, finding Morocco's greatest generation, more than anything else, Moshe loved the Sahara. In a blog he wrote for the Smithsonian Institution, he said, "I can think of no experience," i.e. in his life, that could rival the majestic splendor of the sun setting behind the sand dunes at Murzouga. What bitter ending could there be to a busy day spent mostly at and around the Tafilalt with its bustling center of Risani than the silence of open dunes, climbed by foot or atop a camel just in time to see the twilight falling on the endless desert? The eerie silence engulfs you, and the warm sand threatens to flood your shoes. Moshe was channeling Paul Bowles in a passage I know he'd read, an analysis that worked its way into Paul Bowles' novel Sheltering Sky, which became the Bertolucci film Sheltering Sky with Malkovich and Deborah Winger. But it started in this writing by Paul Bowles. Paul Bowles wrote, "Immediately when you arrive in the Sahara for the first or the tenth time, you notice a stillness. An incredible absolute silence prevails outside the towns. And within, even in busy places like the markets, there is a hushed quality in the air, as if the quiet were a conscious force which, resenting the intrusion of sound, minimizes and disperses sound straight away. Then there is the sky, compared to which all other skies seem faint-hearted, efforts. Solid and luminous, it is always the focal point of the landscape. At sunset, the precise curved shadow of the earth rises into it swiftly from the horizon, cutting into light section and dark section. When all daylight is gone and space is thick with stars, it is still of an intense and burning blue, darkest directly overhead and paling towards the earth, so that the night never really goes dark. You leave the gate of the fort or the town behind, pass by the camels lying outside, go up into the dunes or out onto the hard, stony plain, and stand a while alone. Presently, you will either shiver or hurry back inside the walls, or you will go on standing there and let something very peculiar happen to you, something that everyone who lives there has undergone, and which the French called le baptême de solitude, the baptism of solitude. It's a unique sensation, and it has nothing to do with loneliness, for loneliness presupposes memory. Here in this holy mineral landscape lighted by stars like flares, even memory disappears. A strange, by no means pleasant, process of reintegration begins inside you, and you have the choice of fighting against it and insisting on remaining the person you have always been, or letting it take its course. For no one who has stayed in the Sahara for a while is quite the same as when he came. Perhaps the logical question to ask at this point is, why go? The answer is that when a man has been there and undergone the baptism of solitude, he can't help himself. Once he's been under the spell of the vast, luminous, silent country, no other place is quite strong enough for him. No other surroundings can provide the supremely satisfying sensation of existing in the midst of something that is absolute. He will go back, whatever the cost in time and money, for absolute has no price. Moshe went back there dozens of times. The Bowles quotation is from his travelogue, Their Heads Are Green, Their Hands Are Blue, Scenes from the Non-Christian World. In that work, he talks about the difference between tourists and travelers. He says, whereas the tourist generally hurries back home at the end of a few weeks or months, the traveler belonging no more to one place than the next moves slowly over periods of years from one part of the earth to another. Indeed, he would have found it difficult to tell among the many places he has lived precisely where it was he had felt most at home, describes Moshe. He was a traveler in that Bowlesian sense. Later in one of his travel blogs for Smithsonian Institution, he spoke of his visit to the Jewish Museum in Casablanca. The Jewish Museum in Casablanca is the only one in the Arab world, and along with one in Turkey, one of only two in all 50 Muslim plurality countries. In it, he talks about the new Moroccan constitution following the Arab Spring, in which the constitution says, a sovereign Muslim state attached to its national unity and its territorial integrity, the Kingdom of Morocco intends to preserve in its plenitude and diversity its one and indivisible national identity. Its unity is forged by a convergence of its Arab, Islamist, Berber, and Saharan components, nourished and enriched by African, Andalusian, Hebraic, and Mediterranean influences. The first mention of Judaism that I know of in this level of document in the Arab world. Moshe wrote, the official inclusion of both Berber and Jewish Hebraic identities as components of Moroccan national identity is a very meaningful act, which recognizes the contribution of both Berbers and Jews to Morocco's history and culture. Thus, even though very few Jews continue to reside in Morocco today, those living in other countries, notably Israel, but also in Europe and North America, are still regarded as belonging to the Moroccan nation and are encouraged to visit it and invest in its future. While the physical presence of Jews in Morocco may have nearly ended, their impact on its character continues to be felt nearly everywhere you go. It took Morocco 55 years of independent history and a tumultuous Arab Spring, the largest protest since independence, to begin to fully value the totality of its cultural heritage. And if you don't know the scale of the Moroccan-Israeli connection, something like one-fifth of the voting public in Israel is of Moroccan origin. It's a big community. Searching like Moshe for its origins, marginal to some degree within Israeli society, looking for its place in the world. Moshe exposed silence regarding many Middle Eastern and North African issues that we've all grown to care more about. Silence about veterans, silence about Jews and Jewish heritage, silence about Berbers and Berber heritage, silence about females and males, elderly, children, gay, straight, Jewish, Muslim. Then Moshe traveled here to the heartland. I reached out to some of his former colleagues at MIT, I'm from Boston. Boston calls itself the hub, right? Hub of the universe, right? With no humility. But I reached out to some of his colleagues, and one of them wrote, I remember when he went off to Middle America without any hesitations, I thought a non-US-raised academic might have. And Philip Khoury, his thesis advisor, wrote, when Moshe received tenure at Nebraska, he was asked to organize a major conference at the university and asked me to give the keynote address, which I did. It was my first and so far only foray into the American heartland. He was such a great host, such a dear person. I also know that Moshe had the distinction of putting the winning bid on Harvard President Emeritus Derek Bach's ancient VW Beetle, which he drove proudly around Cambridge. I am deeply saddened by this news. I was the one that reformed him of Moshe's death. I'm deeply saddened by the news. Moshe was the kindest man and someone who believes strongly in Israeli-Palestinian reconciliation. His best friend, I call, was in fact a Palestinian. It was true. Carl Sagan once wrote, extinction is the rule. Survival is the exception. Historians, like anthropologists, often study exceptions, the exceptional. Moshe wrote, and all historians in some way also write, about survival, survival of exceptions, individual survival. How do these people survive? How are the choices they make? What are the negotiations they make with power? Moshe took a great interest in homeless Moroccan children. Again, a completely taboo subject when it's first being exposed. He used to talk to me at length about how do we deal with these kids? What should we do with the kids? What are the institutional steps we can take? He thought a lot about cultural survival, the movement to preserve Moroccan's Jewish heritage. Moshe used to take groups to sites in Sefru where there was nothing there. And now there are things there. He used to take groups to come in and say, this Jewish thing happened here, this Jewish group happened here. And over the years, we've been seeing Moroccans, in part because Moshe was taking groups there, build up these sites. One of the synagogues in Fez was a gym. It was a boxing gym. And now it's a synagogue. And that was a direct result of the effort, largely by Moshe, but of others, to bring people there and pay attention to Morocco's Jewish heritage. He also worked on national survival, the saving of Morocco and Algeria from the French, the saving of Europe from the Nazis, the saving of Palestinians and Palestine from the worst excesses of those who would deny its existence. Human survival, global survival, is something he was here at UNO and elsewhere. He was deeply committed to the Jewish-Muslim dialogue, the Christian-Muslim dialogue. Everyone mattered to Moshe. Historians write about triumph mixed with melancholy, but they also write about failures, rebellions that failed. The Arab Spring was largely a failure. Like the 1848 Springtime of the Peoples, like the Prague Spring, like the Berber Spring, like the first Arab Spring of 2005, people don't know that the first one was based on the Lebanon protests and others. Historians understand better than political scientists that failed rebellions help bring the revolution that comes later. You don't get the American Revolution without the Boston Massacre. You don't get the 1917 Russian Revolution without, still called the Russian Revolution of 1905, the one that failed. And there are generational aspects of this which are important too. However, the Arab Spring is being purged from academia for reasons I'll get into in a minute here. But to understand what's going on, first you have to understand what the Arab Spring was about. And it's what I call the Arab Spring ethos. The Arab Spring ethos was a rebellion by young people in many ways against all the divisions of older generations, dividing ethnic communities against each other, dividing religious communities against each other, dividing LGBT from straight. It was amazing as I participated when I went out there just following the Arab Spring in discussions of the activists how important it was for everyone to have a seat at the table. An interesting anecdote that illustrates this was in Morocco, the February 20th movement, which motored the Arab Spring, had about 90 organizations involved. It was run very much out of Morocco's one sort of independent human rights organization. But the rank and file were largely Islamists. They were from a group called Adl wa Ihsan, Justice and Charity, which was an anti-monarchical, semi-legal group in Morocco. Moshe knew them, knew their leaders. And this group provided the greatest manpower of the February 20th movement and never talked about Islam or Islamist agendas. When they withdrew from the February 20th movement in December of 2011, it was a decision by the senior leadership of Adl wa Ihsan because the Arab Spring movement in Morocco hadn't been Islamic enough. There hadn't been enough Islamic. And the young activists who'd been organizing the protests went in tears to the human rights organization I talked about to tell their friends, we did not agree with this. This was the senior leadership trying to divide us from you. We want to keep going. And it was really interesting over the protests, 12 and 13, the subsequent Arab Spring protests, the Adl wa Ihsan young activists, they weren't allowed by their leadership to participate in the protests, but they would line the streets in support in secular garb and basically saying, we're here for you like you were here for us, and it's not about Islam, right? It's about common values and everyone deserving a place at the table. When I refer to stolen springs, I refer to the effort to purge the Arab Spring analysis from what we're writing. Now, Mark Lynch, my colleague at GW, coined the term Arab Spring in a February 4th, I believe, 2011 article in Foreign Policy. And then he came out with a book called The Arab Uprisings a year later. And he said, why do I term the events, he wrote, the Arab uprising? Because that best captures what is truly unique about this period. I don't like the term Arab Spring, a term I'm embarrassed to have coined, in part because they began in the dead of winter and arguably ended in their most potent form before the turn of the season. The Arab revolutions is premature, since we don't yet know whether any of the Arab countries will manage a fully successful revolutionary change. Arab awakening is misleading, since Arabs were hardly sleeping. Indeed, as the book details at length, the previous decade had been consumed by popular protests, rising dissent, and even more contentious public spheres. The term Arab uprising captures the two most crucial dimensions of this event. Arab, because of the intense identification across borders and diffusion of effects throughout the region, and uprising, because of the surge of popular protests against almost every country. The irony being is that I can't meet a North African who wants to call it an Arab Spring because they see themselves as Amazigh Berber heritage. But more importantly, they don't call it an uprising. These were peaceful protests. That's not an uprising. An uprising is usually violence, usually armed, right? Lynch talked about a lot of other problems in the scholarship of the Arab Springs. Too much faith the academics had in what the activists would accomplish, not understanding how the Islamists would sort of gum things up, the negative impact of foreign intervention in Syria and Libya, making things worse. And yet, not really. Most of the analysis of what the activists were accomplishing, if you look at history over the long durée, is extremely important because there's a generational change, like the 1848 rebellion in Europe, which was the beginning of the end of monarchy in Europe. 30 countries rose up in 1848 in Europe, and a century later, the monarchies are either gone or they're symbolic. Right. This is the same process that's going on in the Arab world. Moshe, who continued to use the word Arab Spring, recognized that. Foreign interventions, even Lynch recognizes that thousands of lives were saved in Libya. But he said it's not enough because Libya went into disarray. Well, you may remember that we had 7 years of battles after the American Revolution in the U.S. as people jogged for what the American country would be like. That's very common. France had another 60 years of turmoil. I mean, after revolutions, there's usually a lot of conflict. The conflict itself isn't the reason not to call something a spring or to recognize spring or to recognize its value. And there's something even kind of worse going on. There's an increasing confluence in Europe between right-wing politics, which is derisive of Arabs and Muslims, and secular authoritarian discourses in the Arab world, which are derisive of everything happened in these popular protests. And they're kind of teaming up together against these popular rebellions in a way that is helping with this authoritarian revanchism, which is actually making things worse in most of these countries. In a famous article in the New York Review of Books by my former boss, Rob Malley, who was at Crisis Group, and then he was Obama's Middle East advisor, and we used to fight about Syria all the time. He wrote an article basically questioning whether the Arab Spring was Islamist or not. For anyone who lived through the Arab Spring, that's a ridiculous question. Given the anecdote I just told you, and many others I could tell you, it's a ridiculous question. Because it wasn't essentially Islamist or essentially not Islamist. The binary makes no sense. Morocco, which had its largest protests since independence, had over a million people in over 100 cities and towns simultaneously protesting, was rocked by the Arab Spring. Now, if you read most of the books in the literature, Morocco had some protests, and they have a new constitution, and things are back to normal, right? Algeria, its largest protest since the 1991 anti-Gerrymandering protests, major changes to the constitution. Arab Spring is the term accepted. Now, I can't tell you how many articles I've read on how there was no spring in Algeria. Tunisia, the one bright, shining success story of the Arab Spring. I can't tell you how much analysis I've read about how a spring didn't happen there and how it's not going to yield much good. A very important thing happened in Tunisia in March of 2016. Right after the U.S. hit Sabratha, you may remember there was a bombing in Sabratha, Libya, in February of 2016. The U.S. was trying to stop an ISIS attack in Tunisia. They killed a lot of people, but they didn't get everybody. And those from ISIS that broke away, did attack Tunisia in March of 2016. The largest number of ISIS fighters in Libya were from this town in the south of Tunisia, Ben Ghedaden. Ben Ghedaden was a pretty Islamist town. Ben Ghedaden was expected by ISIS to be easily taken, and then now we would have a little Islamic caliphate in southern Tunisia. The town rose up against the invaders from Libya, Tunisian invaders from their own town, called in assistance. Tunisian senior officials told me the cooperation with the United States had never been better. U.S. mobilized planes, mobilized intelligence, and helped save the town of Ben Ghedaden from a massacre, defending the Tunisian democratic experiment against one of the worst attacks coming from the east. This sends a hugely important message to Tunisians, to the region, that democracy matters. Increasingly, and I brought Elliot Abrams' book, which I won't get into the details of, but increasingly we're seeing a really interesting new analysis that says, I mean, right now we're facing a rearguard action in the defense of democratization because it's become unpopular. But these, as well argued in the last chapter of this book, Realism and Democracy by Elliot Abrams, Bush's national security advisor, you can't get peace by supporting authoritarians. You get peace ultimately by defending the democratization moves of the countries to the extent that they can and the democracy activists. And this action in Spain, excuse me, in Tunisia, other actions in Libya have been absolutely critical in holding off the worst of what could have happened. The last email I got from Moshe was in the spring of the summer of last year. In the last paragraph, and it said, one last thought about the fifth WACMES, this is the World Council of Muslim Studies, and is in 2018 in Seville, Spain. He said, might be a good idea to co-organize something in Morocco there, always underrepresented at these conferences in Europe. He said, I need a good barber. Moshe was the barber. I looked through the lyrics of The Barber of Seville, And I felt like I was talking to Moshe. I really, Figaro, hilarious character and his toolkit who saves the town, saves the day. The last line in the Barber of Seville was a love, the end of a love poem, basically. And the last line of it is, may love and faith eternal reign in your hearts and our hearts. In memory of Moshe, I'd like to say today, we all need a barber. We all need a mensch. And Moshe Gersovich was about as good as it gets. Thank you.
I did have just, thank you so much, Bill. The words about Moshe, it touches many of us here. I want to especially thank you for highlighting his work on Moroccan veterans that were fighting with the Allies in World War II.
I didn't get into it. They turned the battle. So there were 9 assaults. The first 8 failed with this massive death toll. Let me just mention the rest of that story. I was trying to cut it. The 9th assault was Berber Rifians, Moroccans, up behind the abbey on mules in the dead of night, and they surprised attacked the Germans from behind. And that's what turned the Battle of Monte Cassino after 4 months, and then created the pathway to Rome, which leads to the liberation of France, the southern part of France, and all that in World War II. So the Moroccans were critical in that battle.
And I also want to say I know that Moshe did a lot of work on not just Moroccans but other North African Muslims who played a role in protecting Jews
yes.
during the Holocaust,
yes.
which is also another very, very overlooked contribution. I did have a question, though. You just talked about an alliance between extreme nationalists in Europe with the enemies of the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
Right? This is sponsored by the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies. I thought you could say a little bit more on Israeli responses
to the
Arab Spring.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
there's a conspiracy in the Arab world and much of Europe that the Arab Spring was invented by the Americans, that it was a Soros-funded project related to the color revolutions in Eastern Europe, CIA-financed effort to create democracy activists that would then cause mayhem and bring Islamists to power in the MENA region because, to quote the former French foreign minister Chevènement in his book, The Black and the Green, Americans love Islamists and particularly Wahhabists, and we're trying to sort of take over the Arab world through our alliance with oil and our affinity for radical Islamism. The best evidence that that's not true when I talk to Arabs is the waffling on Egypt. If the U.S. had engineered the Arab Spring, which they absolutely did not, right? And the U.S. was clear on Tunisia early on and clear on Morocco, they waffled on Egypt. And they waffled on Egypt largely because of the Israeli Mubarak alliance, which was critical to Israeli security and the Israelis wanted to preserve. Israeli academics were fascinated with the Arab Spring, and I have many Israeli academic friends who work on things like Berber identity and popular protests in the Arab world who loved studying what happened and were part of this wave of people that Mark Lynch was talking about in 11 and 12 who really enjoyed watching this democratic effort among young. But the Israeli state was ambivalent because it was rocking a set of security arrangements which Israel wanted to preserve for its own survival. So there were Israeli reactions all over the place on the Arab Spring. Certainly a lot of the best writing on the Arab Spring came out of Israel. But certainly there was also a lot of fear and ambivalence towards the democratization efforts that were going on that grew over time. Israel has a complicated relationship with its region. I don't know if you know this, but Israel's working with Al-Qaeda in Syria against Assad, their greater enemy. They support the Al-Qaeda fighters from Nusra Front. They treat them in Israeli hospitals on the border. You know, so there's this, if you sort of look at the constellation of Israeli relationships in the region, it's really sophisticated and really complicated. You know, the short answer is there's no one Israeli position on the Arab Spring. But there's no question that Israel has weathered the storm, the Arab Spring storm, and that Israel will continue to aggressively assert its agenda. And they are very much behind the whole Trump administration effort now forge an alliance against Iran, which would bring Israel together with a set of Arab Sunni countries that are anti-Israel, and what in the Middle East peace process is now being called outside-in. Outside-in in the not yet released Jared Kushner Middle East peace plan is the idea that this anti-Iran alliance will have as a corollary of it Middle East peace. I'm a little bit skeptical of this approach, because I don't think Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, and Egypt in particular are going to be able to forge deals with Arab states before there's a deal on Palestine. That said, the informal connections with Israel are deepening in business, in telecommunications, secret flights, you know, all kinds of cooperation levels with Israel are going up. All opportunities afforded Israel by the post-Arab Spring aftermath. So the Israeli understanding of what's going on in the region is very sophisticated. You know, what sort of publicly comes out is only a small part of the story. I would say the one other good thing about what's going on right now in Washington is that a year ago, nobody in Israel was talking about Middle East peace. It was sort of off the table. Now everyone's talking about it. And so we have a new moment and a new opportunity right now in at least beginning, and to quote Jared Kushner, an outside-of-the-box discussion on Middle East peace.
Thank you.
Yes, I kind of perked up, and hopefully I've been perked up through your whole talk, but you used the words efforts to purge it, and I thought about that. Well, my youngest son's a PhD historian,
yeah,
and I'm getting old, but I'd like to think my grandchildren would read history,
yeah,
and that it's allegedly objective,
yeah,
right? I mean, there was something called World War II, Vietnam War,
yeah,
but then the subjectivity about history, that's, and the purging, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And when you said efforts to purge it,
yeah,
tell me about efforts. That sounds like more than one individual. Or is it just this individual, this individual, this individual?
Fascinating question.
One way
I'd answer it is I have a whole lecture I give on the taxonomy of Arab Spring books. And it's really interesting. The early books were very good, raw, unfiltered, largely accurate. One of the best ones being Filiou's book, a French scholar who sort of captured a lot of what was going on. We all thought over time the history of the Arab Spring would get better and better. Grosso modo, it's getting worse and worse and worse for a number of reasons. One set of reasons are ideological and another set of reasons are disciplinary, right? There are more and more books coming out about how climate change started the Arab Spring. There are more and more books coming out about how it was a U.S. NATO plot, the imperialist set of books, right? There's more and more books coming out about, very narrowly, this historical cause or this political science cause or this media cause or this or this. And it's more, with more and more being produced, it's more and more to selectively read everything that came before, right? And then run it through your biases, your disciplinary biases, and come up with a cocktail which is, with each successive generation of books, more and more disconnected from what not only what happened in 11, what's happening now, right? So there's these disciplinary biases which aren't part of the purge, but there's also ideological biases. So in the imperialist left, right, there's a huge effort to say intervention in Syria was bad, intervention in Libya was bad, and these weren't Arab Springs, right? Except that half of Libya fell in a couple of days in an Arab Spring, 8,000 army defections. Tripoli fell in 24 hours. The military leaders just handed over all their weapons. There was an Arab Spring even in Libya, right? Although it's fashionable to say it wasn't because of this anti-NATO, which the Russians articulate too in all their propaganda. There wasn't an Arab Spring in Tunisia, wasn't an Arab Spring anywhere. There are ideological positions that are being taken. And I think within that context, people fall into sort of a comfort zone because of their ideological positions. One part of what's wrong with this new analysis is that, for example, Syria didn't really have a Western. We make this big deal about CIA financing a couple of militias, but for years it really didn't have much of an impact. You may have read how ineffective, right? There wasn't really a Western intervention in Syria until Russia came in. The Syrian story is almost the opposite. It's no intervention. What goes wrong when there's no humanitarian intervention? Libya was a very different story, and the casualty rates in Libya are 1% of those in Syria, and a bloodbath was stopped, right? And there is a constitution being written in Libya, and there's a chance. I mean, Syria is about to break up. Libya has a shot, in part because of so little violence occurring in Libya, so little violence because of the NATO intervention. Obama said his great regret as president was Libya, and everyone mistook that for ideological reasons as he regretted going into Libya. No, if you read the interview at The Atlantic, it was the lack of follow-through in Libya. It's the fact that there was no international stabilization force, and everyone left after November of 2011, and Libya slowly fell apart, and that second civil war started in 2014, right? So there are huge ideological underpinnings, right, to this poor analysis that's going on. And this gets back to your question about purge, make these debates quite strident. So I've actually been at meetings where, people get angry at me for still using the word Arab Spring, because it doesn't match their ideological viewpoint on what's going on. So yeah, it's a purging, and I can't tell you how many books are being written about the Arab uprisings, which I would say never occurred in North Africa, my main area of study. More and more books coming out on Arab uprisings when the entire region of North Africa still considers it a spring and still considers it positive, even in Libya for the most part. You know, so that there's an idea. It's the ideological element.
Thank you. I just want to say that Bill is the guy to ask questions to about the Middle East, North Africa, and I just wanted to throw a follow-up before I hand it back to Patrick.
Yeah.
What's going on in Saudi Arabia?
Ah, yes.
Right? And I can stage that as a follow-up to the question about Israel and the Arab Spring, but it just seems like the situation, nobody really knows. Maybe you do. Please.
Yeah. Huge topic. So basically, Saudi Arabia just sacked the prime minister of Lebanon. How did that happen? He shows up at Riyadh Airport, and instead of getting the VIP thing, a security confiscated his phone, and off he went with no official welcome. Hariri is a Saudi citizen. His Saudi side of his family have business interests. In a distributive rentier economy like Saudi Arabia, you survive on government contracts. I'm sure there's either a stated or a non-stated pressure on the Hariri to, if he doesn't do what the Saudis want, you know, his family suffers economically. He had, of course, that interesting interview on Saturday where he said he's going back. And I asked all my Beirut friends in Beirut and Lebanon expert friends, I said, what if Hariri, after being sacked by the Saudis, forced to resign, then goes back to Beirut and says, I'm not turning in my resignation letter. I want to be prime minister again. And the unanimous response I got was good. And I'm like, how can you be prime minister if you've just been sacked by another country coming back? And they said, because there's nobody else. The Lebanese constitution requires a Sunni prime minister, and there's someone else, the president has to be another group, and the other senior positions are held by these sectarian groups. It's very complicated, and there's no other Sunni besides Hariri who could hold this position. So everyone's willing to have a weak Hariri and even weaker Hariri than before, you know, to settle things out. The backdrop, to answer your question, is the war in Yemen's not going well. The blockade, the Egyptian, the UAE, Bahrain, Saudi blockade of Qatar is not going well. And a lot of the things that MBS, bin Salman, is trying to accomplish are being undermined by these failures. And then he goes and arrests dozens of princes under the guise of anti-corruption, including the 53rd richest man in the world, who's a major investor in Facebook and Twitter and Apple, and you know, and these guys all got their assets sort of, not, if not frozen, somehow controlled by the state, and there's been torture going on, and lots of guys still in jail, or house arrest, like was done to the Lebanese prime minister, all under the guise of anti-corruption, but it's more about bin Salman solidifying his power. Now, bin Salman has a very ambitious agenda. By 2030, he wants Saudi Arabia to be very modern. I don't know if you've noticed this NEOM. I was just listening in the radio yesterday. Bill Gates is investing $100 million in this? Is it in Nebraska? It's in Nevada, I think, or Arizona. This automated modern city where everything will be robotic and cars will drive themselves, and like this big project. The Saudi NEOM project is that times 10. They're basically building, there was a joke on Facebook about the first beheading of a robot, you know, but there's this huge futuristic automated robot city being built in eastern Saudi Arabia as part of this 2030 vision. They just started to allow women to drive again, which is an issue a lot of my American diplomat friends have been deeply involved with, in pressuring the Saudi Arabia to allow women to drive. In fact, some of my American diplomats did a lawsuit to be allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia, which was interesting. But Things are in flux in Saudi Arabia. MBS is consolidating power best he can. I don't think anyone's going to get in MBS's way, but there's definitely rumblings. There's a backlash coming, which I don't think, let me put it this way, I don't think it'd be powerful enough to undo MBS's agenda, but it's coming. Unfortunately, some of it's going to come from the Wahhabists, right? Of course, all Saudis are Wahhabist, but you know, there's sort of two kinds of Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia. There's the really hardcore ISIS type Wahhabism, and then there's the state Wahhabism, which believes in a lot of those social positions, but is pro monarchy, pro state, pro, and they are skittish about the coming social reforms. I have to say, from my several trips to Saudi Arabia, how impressed I was with young women entrepreneurs in Saudi Arabia. It's absolutely astounding to see the women doing startups, high-tech efforts, social media platforms. The science and technology universities, which have massive investment, are like Koust, are amazing places to be at. And so you have this burgeoning, youthful society that wants rapid change. They've somewhat embraced MBS because he's doing this as a reformer, but he's reforming in a very authoritarian way. So how that breaks over time is going to be interesting, and the future is unclear.
Bill, I really want to just take a tiny bit of time to say thank you for coming and sharing a lot of your insights. I've learned a lot today, and I want to say you're always welcome to come back to Omaha.
With pleasure.
And to UNO to
And I won't wait 4 years this time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by William Lawrence, visiting professor at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University, and former U.S. State Department Senior Advisor for Global Engagement. He spoke on the topic Silence, Survival, and Stolen Springs, the Middle East and North Africa. This program was sponsored by the Hannah and Natan Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at UNO and presented in memory of UNO professor and former director of the Schwalb Center, Moshe Gershovich, who passed away 1 year ago this week on February 8, 2017. It was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, November 15, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, Associate Director of Media Relations in the University of Nebraska at Omaha Office of University Communications, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.